From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in for Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. A South Korean envoy has announced a potentially major breakthrough with North Korea. Officials in the South say Kim Jong-un is willing to discuss giving up his nuclear weapons and suspend nuclear missile tests during negotiations with the United States. President Trump tweeted this morning that the news may be false hope, but the U.S. is willing to go hard in either direction. Here and Now, security analyst Jim Walsh is here. He's with MIT Security Studies Program. And Jim, on the surface, this sounds like a very big headline, is it?
Yes. Well, before I pour a bucket of caveats over it, I would say, yes, it's good news, and I don't get to say that very often. I mean, if the parties are talking, whether they're making progress or not, they're still less likely to end up in a shooting war, whether by accident or by design. And if the North Koreans are suspending their testing program, well, that slows their advances, particularly as it relates to long-range missiles. And I would say, finally, it's a win for the South Korean President Moon. I mean, people were sort of criticizing him and expressing skepticism. I think he's sort of showed them that, in fact, this has real potential.
Well, I want to ask you about that. The pictures of the South Korean envoy shaking hands with Kim Jong-un, remarkable. And a lot of people said that the diplomacy that South Korea had put forward during the Olympics probably wouldn't last past the closing ceremonies. But it sounds like maybe President Moon Jae-in deserves a little credit here.
Oh, I think he does. And his success here, and again, we'll have to see where it goes, should remind all of us in the U.S. That we make the mistake often of thinking that this is the U.S. versus North Korea. And it's not. The South, you know, if there's a war, they fight it on South Korea's territory. And they have a, should have a voice here. And they also provide the possibility that we can navigate and avoid all this.
Is it a sign at all that U.S. sanctions, the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure, that they're working? And we've talked about that every single time you're in the studio, it seems like. Is it working?
Well, it is certainly possible that their motivation is because they feel like they're being hurt by sanctions. There's not a lot of evidence that they are being hurt by sanctions, and it certainly doesn't seem like their nuclear and missile programs are slowing down, but it's possible. It could be, for example, that the threats that the president has made have focused their attention. There are all sorts of explanations. Unfortunately, we won't know the real story until this is all said and done.
Okay, the caveats. Let's say the talks do start. Still very, very complicated territory. What do you expect the U.S. strategy to be?
Well, this is where the hard part actually begins. So the North Koreans said they want a security guarantee. Well, what does that mean? Who's going to provide that? You know, I don't know that the U.S. can actually provide a security guarantee to its arch enemy, North Korea. In the past, North Korean officials have told me what that means is no U.S. troops on the peninsula. Now, that's something...
That's a big lift.
That's a huge lift. But it's also something that I think the South Korean leadership may be more open to than the American leadership. You know, will we halt military exercises during the negotiations? Will we stop announcing new sanctions? Those are all big questions going forward.
Kim Jong-un also agreed to meet with President Moon Jae-in in late April. They've got this hotline that they're setting up so that they can talk to each other directly to diffuse tensions if they arise. Is there a sense in your mind that even if the talks with the United States break down, that South Korea is still just determined to work on this by itself?
Well, I think that's right. I think that's a philosophy that President Moon came to office with and is different from his predecessors. He's sort of about South Korea being its own independent sovereign country. But let me say, this is a little bit like major surgery. You know, you have to have the surgery or you're going to die. But then again, the surgery has real risks. And if it fails, you could die. You know, we can end up in a situation where if it doesn't go well, the positions are hardened and the risks go up. You got a sort of a bit of sense of that from the president's tweets saying, well, if this doesn't work, you know, he might drive hard in the opposite direction.
All right. Big developments there on this story. Here and Now, security analyst Jim Walsh. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, Arkansas has now become the third state to require some residents to work or take employment training in order to receive Medicaid benefits after the Trump administration gave the green light to the state's plan yesterday. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services did not approve Arkansas's request to roll back the Obamacare expansion of Medicaid that allowed people just above the poverty level to receive coverage. That request from Arkansas is on hold. But the work requirement is expected to start this summer, and recipients have 3 months to fulfill it or lose Medicaid, but also be locked out of the program until the following calendar year, even if they do get work. Let's bring in Arkansas Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson. Governor Hutchinson, thanks for your time.
Great to be with you today.
And you know, your critics yesterday said this is punitive. You said it's not. I want to get to that. But first, more about what your state's plan is. Medicaid, of course, the federal program implemented by states, mostly the poor, the elderly, the disabled, children. And your requirement has some exemptions?
Indeed, it does. And our work requirement only applies to those that are able-bodied, that do not have dependent children at home, or have some other type of exception or medically frail. And so these are those that are able to work and either should be in training to go to work or should be working.
Well, as you know, this is potentially a very small number. Kaiser Health did a national survey. They found about half of non-elderly Medicaid recipients were working full-time, 18% were working part-time, 32% of the remaining number weren't working because of illness or disability, or they are caregivers or going to school. That left only 7% not working. What number are you looking at?
Well, I'm looking at about 69,000 in Arkansas. And so we're looking at those between the ages of 20 and 49, their prime of their working years. And we have a 3.7% unemployment rate. We need more people in the workforce, more people trained. So this is a very good thing.
So you say of the 69,000 in your expansion, all of those are able-bodied, able-to-work adults?
Yes, those are ones that do not have the exception. We have a total of 288,000 on the Medicaid expansion. And so this work requirement will probably apply to about 69,000 that do not meet an exemption or who are not already working. But when you're looking at Arkansas workforce, 69,000 is a lot.
But it is, but I'm a little confused because the expansion, what it did was raise the level of poverty to include people who are slightly above the $12,000 income per individual poverty level to about 16,000 per individual, and I think it's double that for a family of four. And that implies that people on the expansion have some kind of income, are working.
Well, a large percent of them are. And so the 69,000 I'm speaking of are those who are not working or who are not making minimum wage for 80 hours a month. And if you're not making minimum wage for 80 hours a month, then you need to have further training, hopefully, to move up and provide better. Let's don't let them be locked into that wage rate and where they're in a state of poverty for the rest of their life.
Well, you know what the response to this, Joan Alker, who's executive director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University, says that this is misguided. Everyone agrees it's great to have people trained, get better paying jobs. But at the same time, the state isn't providing these job training services. You're not paying for them. You're not providing funding for childcare or transportation or addressing other barriers that people might have to get a job or a better job, including my understanding is that there's going to be a portal that people have to go online and prove that they are working. And many very low-income people struggling with poverty can't do that. And to add one more layer of bureaucracy is going to push them down the ladder to success, not up.
Well, the portal is designed to make it easy. We are making sure that we have our workforce training programs in place and so that we can be of assistance. And so under the very weak referral that we had under the Obama administration, we still had 4,000 people that were referred over for worker training and went to work. And so I don't think 4,000 people who advance their life is a bad thing. I think it is a very good thing. And if we can enhance that even to a larger extent, they're better off and our state is better off.
And of course, everyone's hope is that people who can will work. But are you at all concerned, as others are, that this will in fact have the opposite effect? It'll make people give up. You know, we spoke to a mother a while back who was on Medicaid in Kentucky. She already works two part-time jobs, was despairing as to how she was going to work more to fulfill the hour requirement in Kentucky. Are you worried that people just give up and you will have people back in emergency rooms and uncovered and a more expensive issue to deal with?
When you're looking at 20 hours a week, any lady who's working two part-time jobs, I'm sure is working 20 hours a week. And so the point is, if you're able-bodied, let's contribute if you're going to receive social benefits.
Well, and as we said at the beginning, you do not think this is punitive, but just talk about the lockout. If they do not fulfill the work requirements after 3 months, they will then be locked out for the calendar year. any concerns about what seems to others to be a punitive nature there? I mean, why not have an entry level kind of, you know, here we're going to have job training programs easing up to the requirement that you have jobs?
Well, these are people that are not accessing worker training programs now, and so there has to be a consequence for not fulfilling your responsibility. And so we'll see, but I think that you'll see in the end that we'll be able to have a large, high percentage of compliance.
That's Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. His state plans to start the work requirement for Medicaid by this summer. Governor Hutchinson, thank you.
It's good to be with you today. Thank you.
And a story now about the Me Too movement coming to Harvard over decades. Terry Carl was a rising star there when she arrived in 1981 as an assistant professor. Her mentor was Jorge Dominguez, a senior Latin American scholar. She says she fought off his sexual harassment, then reported him. Harvard found him guilty of serious misconduct, but he was allowed to stay. And Terry Carl eventually left for Stanford. Then Carl heard from other women. The Chronicle of Higher Education did an investigation. This Sunday, Dominguez was placed on full leave. And just hours ago, Harvard confirmed he is immediately resigning his administrative roles and will leave teaching at the end of the semester. Reporters Tom Bartlett and Nell Gluckman titled their story, "She Left Harvard, He Got to Stay." Nell, you spoke with several women, and then more came forward after you published last week.
Yeah. Immediately after it was printed, we started hearing from more women. In total, since it was published, we heard from close to 10 more women. And then we learned on Sunday evening, as you said, that he was placed on administrative leave, and they're going to take a close look at these allegations and determine how to go forward.
Well, as you point out in your writing, this is a different time. This is the Me Too era. It's still hard, though, to read of some of the things that Terry Carl says happened back in 1981. And in fact, the school seems to agree happened because they found him guilty of serious misconduct. He attempted to kiss her. What were some of the allegations?
So he did kiss her. He, according to Terry, groped her. He propositioned her. This took place over 2 years and, you know, according to Terry, was constant and relentless and really made her time at Harvard just almost impossible to deal with.
Well, these allegations that he kissed her, slit his hand up her skirt, were always coupled, though, with a threat of her advancement there because he was in a position of power. He would be telling her things like, "I'm going to be the next department chair." What did she read into that?
Like you said, a threat. He was the person she was paired with. He could have potentially reviewed her books, determined whether she got promoted, determined eventually whether she got tenured. So, yeah, she did interpret that as threatening.
What was some of the evidence that you saw, in addition, again, to the school finding him guilty after she eventually filed a formal complaint? What were some of the notes that she had?
Terry had kept everything, letters from deans, letters to colleagues, notes that she wrote to herself, and it really sort of told a story and allowed us to sort of reconstruct, you know, what happened to her over this 2-year period.
Well, and why do you think this happened? Tell us more about him. He was also a superstar on campus.
When Terry got there in 1981, he was a tenured professor of government. He was on the boards of many journals and then continued to move up at Harvard into higher administrative places. And for Terry, he was also, since he was a Latin Americanist and she was a Latin Americanist, he was sort of the person, her natural mentor.
And how was he casting these accusations?
When we spoke to him, he wasn't able to comment on Carl's accusations. When we asked him about the later accusations that we learned about, he cast the whole thing as a misunderstanding. And from what we heard from other people who spoke to him at the time, that was similar to things that he said to them about the Carl case.
She was hearing that, in fact, he cast it as an affair gone sour.
That's certainly what we heard from students that they shared in common. And that was one of Terry's concerns. She felt that the process at Harvard was not transparent. And while they found him guilty of serious misconduct, the details, you know, remained private. And so that allowed him to talk about this in whatever way he wished to talk about it. And she, you know, worried about her reputation moving forward.
Well, and she, though, went to Stanford University, earned her tenure there, finished the book that she was working on. And then last November, She got an email from another woman. What was that?
Yeah, she heard from another woman who had an incident in the 1990s and had Googled Jorge Dominguez and sexual harassment when the Me Too movement started because it had got her thinking about her experience. She connected with Terry, reached out to her, and was also able to connect with another woman by posting on a Harvard Facebook page, and somebody put her in touch with someone else who had had a similar incident in the 1990s.
Well, and before we go forward with some of these other women, give us a little more context. Terry Carl, again, who she's walking with this man, and she says at one point he looks over at a forested area and says that would be a good place for a rape. He once introduced her at a dinner to someone very important in her field by saying in Spanish, "This is my slave." But she didn't even know the term sexual harassment back then.
That's right. She, after this happened, spent a lot of time, she told us, looking up sexual harassment, learning as much as she could about it, reaching out to the people that were writing about it at the time. But she really had to educate herself back then when it was a relatively new term. Universities didn't have these robust Title IX offices back then. So she really had to reach out to people on her own to sort of figure out what she was interpreting Dominguez's actions to really be and what the implications could be for her career.
It's just stunning to realize that, you know, a federal court only recognized sexual harassment as discrimination in education in 1977 because of a case that was brought there. I mean, it was just not always thus. So, Tom, take us forward. Other women start coming forward. What were their experiences?
I mean, some of their experiences mirrored what happened with Terry Carl. And one thing to note is the women we've spoken to, they include fellow professors, graduate students, undergraduate students, staff members. And I mean, they talk about a range of experiences from being suddenly kissed, from being touched in ways that are inappropriate, from constant unwanted attention, flirtatious emails. It's a range of behavior. And a lot of their stories also share a real similarity where they first see Dominguez as a mentor and as someone who can be helpful to them, and then things turn uncomfortable.
At one point, Terry Carl wrote a letter to Dominguez, which she shared with Harvard administrators. She spelled out his behavior, how she interpreted it. She hired a lawyer. When Harvard finally did take action, he had some administrative duties taken away. He was told that future problems would have more serious consequences. She, Terry Carl, was given 3 paid semesters of leave. Her tenure clock was put on hold so that she didn't lose time. That was a good thing for her. But he was her path to advancement.
That's exactly right. And she really, I mean, Terry goes on to have this really just amazing career at Stanford. But there's a moment there where she leaves Harvard where she's not sure her academic career is going to continue. There are whispers of scandal that are going to follow her. Leaving Harvard is for anyone, you know, going to Harvard would be a dream job. But she's convinced that she can't stay. She really sees Dominguez as a threat, and she doesn't believe the university is going to protect her.
She still was in meetings with him. He was still on campus. So she still felt his presence.
What does Harvard say about this?
They say that they dealt with this back in the 80s. They will certainly acknowledge that we've had a big culture change from 1983 to now, obviously, and that they dealt with this sort of as best they could in that era. At the time, in private letters to Terry, they acknowledged that this was misconduct, that this was horrible, that they are very upset this has ever happened. And while, you know, Terry appreciated the acknowledgement, she felt that they weren't actually following through and protecting her and actually doing something to stop this.
Well, and when she does realize there are other women, when they get in touch with her, and as she says to you, her response is, "Oh, my God, I knew he was going to keep doing it." And the implication is we have no idea how many other women there might be.
I mean, I think that's one of the larger takeaways from this story for us is thinking about reporting procedures. There are women who, for decades, in various ways, were speaking out. They were speaking out to higher ups. They were talking to counselors. They were talking to advisors. They were talking to deans. And in many cases, they felt that they weren't being heard and those complaints weren't going beyond that conversation.
When your article went to press, Jorge Dominguez was not only working at Harvard, he had significant status there. And in 2016, a prestigious award worth $54,000 was named in his honor. But you write about people furiously working behind the scenes to somehow alter it because they knew of the claims against him.
It's one of the things that's really interesting about this story is that while there were people who continued to collaborate with Jorge Dominguez and promoted him up through Harvard. There have always been people who have known about this case who have refused to work with Dominguez. And when this award came up a couple of years ago, they did work behind the scenes to scuttle it. And as one of them told us, they felt that this wasn't a man who deserved this kind of recognition.
And then, as we said at the outset, this past weekend, you came out with a second article, New Allegations, and the Harvard Response. Is there a sense that this represents something more than this one professor?
I think there are women who would say yes, it definitely does. And I think one of the reasons we wanted to focus on Terry Carl's case, you know, is because it's Harvard and other universities look to Harvard. Harvard sort of thinks of itself as America's university and as this real brand name and this iconic place. And so what happens there sort of has meaning beyond just that institution.
But Nell, I'm sure that Jorge Dominguez has his defenders, too, who say, as you write, that he was a close mentor to people.
Sure. We've talked to people who thought he was a fantastic teacher and a fantastic mentor. And that's one of the sad things about this, because some of the women that we spoke to for the story also found him to be those things, but they felt like they were denied access to his classes, to research projects that he might have been a part of, because they felt they needed to avoid him.
We've been speaking with Chronicle of Higher Education reporters Tom Bartlett and Nell Gluckman. Their article, She Left Harvard, He Got to Stay, detailed harassment charges against Harvard University professor Jorge Dominguez. Again, Jorge Dominguez had been put on leave, but he resigned hours ago. A Harvard statement read, "Other women thinking of coming forward should now know that they are supported."
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Like a lot of people, you might have a smart speaker in your home. The voice-activated devices deliver news and weather information. They can also control home appliances and, of course, help you buy stuff online. Recently, we reported on how smart speakers are being used by people in Georgia to make government information more accessible to its citizens. Today, John Kalish reports that Amazon's Echo is being used to improve the lives of blind people.
Bill Boulis works for a nonprofit that assists current and former members of the military and their families who've lost their vision. He's been helping clients install and use the Echo. Boulis is blind himself. He got an Echo as soon as they came out.
Using the Amazon Echo was a game changer for me. I used to hate having to depend on my family to do things like help me find something on the on-screen guide, right? I'm blind. I can't see the on-screen guide, but I can do it independently now. I no longer have to depend on somebody else to help me find something to watch.
Besides using it to interact with a cable TV on-screen guide, the Echo can be used to hail a car from a ride service like Lyft or Uber and order groceries from Peapod, the online grocery delivery service. Christina Brino, a blind woman who lives in Pompton Plains, New Jersey, tells her Echo what groceries to put on the list.
It's so nice. You could be walking in the house and you say, oh, I need this. You could say, Alexa, ask Peapod. And then I could ask her what I want and she just adds it to my cart.
Like other blind Echo users I spoke to, Brino has several Echoes in her home, including a battery-powered model she uses outdoors. I met a blind tech entrepreneur named Mike May, who lives in Seattle. He has 10 Echoes in two homes he divides his time in. The guy is happily married, but he does admit to having an intimate relationship with another woman.
There's a real Alexa out there somewhere that the voice is based on. She's so much a part of my life, I feel like I know her.
Mike May was sitting down when I broke the news to him that Alexa was really Amy. It turns out the Royal National Institute of Blind People in England commissioned a Polish software company to create synthetic voices to convert newspaper copy into audio files that blind people could listen to. Amy was one of those synthetic voices, but Amazon changed her name to Alexa in 2013 when it acquired the Polish software company.
In a way, this is the dawning of a new interface. This is an audio interface where there is no recourse to a screen.
That's Stephen Tyler, a Brit who worked at the Royal National Institute of Blind People when these synthetic voices were commissioned. He's blind and works in the field of assistive technology.
5 years ago, Alexa would definitely have been an accessibility product. Today, it's a mainstream product. It just so happens that it's accessibility in spades. It's the kind of story that I think we really need to shout about in the disability community.
One model of the Echo comes with a video camera that utilizes machine learning to dispense fashion advice. Some blind people are thinking about using it to help them with their wardrobe selection as they get dressed for work in the morning. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
So what's going on with Sam Nunberg? He's the former Trump campaign aide who gave a series of TV interviews to increasingly incredulous news anchors yesterday, saying he would refuse to comply with a subpoena from special counsel Robert Mueller that seeks emails and other communications he'd had with associates on the Trump campaign. Here's Nunberg speaking to MSNBC's Katie Turr.
The subpoena is absolutely ridiculous. Why should I hand them over every email I've had with Steve Bannon or Roger Stone since November? And you know what? Since November of 2015, give me a break.
Sam, let him arrest me, Nunberg told the Washington Post. But by Monday night, he told the AP, I'm going to end up cooperating with them. Philip Rucker is White House bureau chief for the Washington Post. And Phil, many Americans are waking up saying, who is Sam Nunberg? So thank you for helping us out.
Yeah, well, glad to be here. So Sam Nunberg is a New York-based political consultant, but he came into Trump's orbit back about 4 or 5 years before Trump decided to run for president. Sam was working for Trump at Trump Tower as his political strategist and operative. So he would manage Trump's political activities, his fundraising, to the extent that Trump traveled around the country appearing at political events. It was Nunberg who helped organize all of that. And Nunberg also helped then, you know, potential candidate Mr. Trump developed some of his policy ideas, like his Build the Wall plan on immigration.
Well, let me jump in there for a second to say it's been reported that Sam Nunberg was part of a troika, including Steve Bannon and Roger Stone, the political consultant that Nunberg calls his mentor. And they came up with the phrase the wall, hoping to give the president something to hold on to move their immigration agenda.
I believe that's right. You know, Sam describes himself as the architect of that strategy and is somebody who really played to Donald Trump's nationalist instincts and had a feel out in the country for what sort of message would resonate with the conservative grassroots, which at that time was a restive and potentially explosive force in American politics on the Republican side.
One of the Trump biographies talks about how they asked the president to try out this phrase, the wall, and he was so pleased with the response to it, the president was, that he kept it up. But remind us again, just so we know the players here, I mentioned Roger Stone, the political consultant who famously has a picture of Richard Nixon tattooed on his back. Sam Nunberg was said over and over again yesterday, he's my mentor. I'm not going to testify against him. I'm not going to, you know, this seemed to be part of what was driving him. Who's Roger Stone?
Well, Roger Stone is a self-described dirty trickster. He's a really interesting figure who's been on the fringes, but at moments in the center of American politics for decades now. He had been for a while Donald Trump's main political strategist. Sam Nunberg was Stone's protege. Nunberg was more of a staffer for Trump full time, whereas Stone was sort of the roving mastermind consultant. But both of them had a falling out with Donald Donald Trump shortly after Trump announced his candidacy. Nunberg was actually fired by Trump in August of 2015 after some racially charged Facebook posts that Nunberg wrote surfaced publicly. He had a falling out with Trump as well as with Corey Lewandowski, who at the time was the campaign manager, and Roger Stone resigned soon thereafter. So Stone and Nunberg, very influential figures in the birth of the Trump candidacy, but a little bit more on the fringes during the campaign itself.
So what was Mueller asking of him?
Well, Mueller was asking Nunberg to produce documentation of his contacts with a number of Trump officials dating back for years. Contacts with Corey Lewandowski, contact with Roger Stone, contact with Steve Bannon, as well as with other staffers, Hope Hicks, who was the press secretary on the campaign, and others.
And why Sam Nunberg contacted the Washington Post, I believe, before this television junket started, when he started appearing. What did he say to you?
Well, Nunberg actually talked to my colleague Josh Dossi and, first of all, provided a copy of the subpoena, the actual documentation that he was given by Mueller on the record, and went on the record to detail his resistance to Mueller and explain why he was going to defy the subpoena. He actually said, "Let him arrest me."
Well, why?
Those were Nunberg's quotes.
Well, why?
He felt like the request from Mueller was too much, that he feels he has done nothing wrong and didn't understand why he needed to provide that documentation. And he also felt like Mueller was on a witch hunt, not only against the president, but against Roger Stone. Nunberg didn't want to be complicit in any effort to undermine or perhaps incriminate Roger Stone.
Well, he also alluded to previous lines of questioning that he'd had with the special counsel and where he thought the special counsel was going. He said he thought Mueller might already have incriminating evidence. Here he is again with Ter on MSNBC.
I want to hear directly from you. Do you think that they have something on the president?
I think they may.
What?
I think that he may have done something during the election, but I don't know that for
Why
sure.
Why do you think that?
I can't explain it unless you're in there.
So what is he basing this on?
Well, he's basing it on the line of questioning that he had when he sat down with the special counsel's team. He, of course, Nunberg does not know what Mueller has concluded overall. He doesn't know what Mueller has asked and obtained from any number of other witnesses. But he does know what Mueller asked him. And, that has led Nunberg to believe that the special counsel's team may have something incriminating on the president. I thought it was one of the most interesting moments in what was a very good interview by Katie Ter yesterday, because it's the first time we've really heard directly on the record from a witness in this Russia probe the direction that it's going and any indication of the portrait that Mueller is painting of all of this.
Look, what do you think we were watching yesterday? Some have speculated as to whether or not the media should have put him on as the day went on because he seemed to be unhinged. And then you had that remarkable moment with CNN's Aaron Burnett. Let's listen.
Talking to you,
yeah.
I have smelled alcohol on your breath.
Well, I have not had a drink.
You haven't had a drink, so that's not true.
No.
He went on to say that he was on medication. What do you think we were watching? You're someone who's known Sam Nunberg. Is this somebody who may be unhinged and, members of the media, NPR Scott Simon, wondering whether he should have been put on the air, others saying if he's unhinged by the Russia investigation, that's something important to know? Or were we seeing What really is in some ways a very juvenile bad boy? I mean, this is the same Trump aide who admitted to Politico, as the Washington Post reminds us, last November that he made up that story about then New Jersey Governor Chris Christie fetching McDonald's food for Donald Trump to embarrass Christie. So maybe that's who we're seeing, just somebody who, is just making trouble.
So I have known Sam Nunberg for years now, and the Sam Nunberg who was on television in all those interviews yesterday is the exact same Sam Nunberg that I've dealt with over the years. I mean, this is who he is. This is how he talks. This is the way he sort of thinks out loud. He's not always entirely truthful and honest, but there tends to be some kernel of truth in what he's saying. But he's a political operator. He learned his craft from Roger Stone. He fine-tuned candidate with Donald Trump. And this is Sam Nunberg. As for whether the media should have had him on the air, look, there is tremendous news value in what he said initially on the record. This is the first witness in the Russia investigation that we've had come forward and detail what those interviews were like and detail the kind of information Mueller is seeking and the information Mueller has obtained from him. And I think that's really newsworthy.
Yeah.
I mean, whether he should have been on for like 5-6 successive lengthy interviews live on cable television, maybe it was too much. I don't know. I'm not a media critic, but I will defend the initial reporting.
Well, and the Post also got in touch with Susan McDougall, who was the Bill Clinton business partner who spent 18 months behind bars because she refused to testify before a grand jury. This was during the Whitewater controversy. She says she refused to testify because she had nothing to say. So what do you think will happen in the long run? Because he could be facing jail as she did, and he's insinuated he knows things but just doesn't have the time or doesn't want to talk about his friends. What might happen if he doesn't testify?
Well, I think that's a great question because we don't know what Mueller will do, but I imagine Mueller will take some retaliatory action, if only because it would send a signal to other witnesses that they cannot defy the special counsel. But it's important to point out that Nunberg said late last night that he was likely to cooperate in some fashion later this week. So it's all in the to-be-determined category.
Yeah. Philip Rucker, White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari said yesterday that he will visit the town of Dapchi in northeast Nigeria after the mass kidnapping of 110 schoolgirls last month. Authorities say the girls were abducted by members of the jihadist group Boko Haram. Militants reportedly raided a school, dredging up memories of the 2014 abductions in Chibok, Nigeria that spawned the hashtag #BringBackOurGirls. 100 of the 276 girls kidnapped there are still missing to this day. The BBC's Stephanie Hagerty has been reporting on this story, and she joins us now from Lagos. Stephanie, you've spoken with some of the girls who managed to escape this latest abduction. What did they tell you happened that day?
Well, they said it was around 7 p.m. when the militants came into their school, and most of them were in their dormitories. They were preparing they were getting ready to pray, actually, for evening prayers, and then getting their dinner. And one girl we spoke to, she was with her best friend Zara at the time, and when they heard gunshots firing, they ran. And in the midst of all the madness, she lost Zara, and it turned out that Zara was kidnapped. And she told us that they ran, most of the girls ran from the dormitory across the school grounds to the main gate, which was locked, and then they had to hop over a wall. And when they hopped over that wall, they found more Boko Haram militants on the other side. Mm. This girl, Fatima, that we spoke to, she ran off in the other direction, but she thinks that Zara went with the militants. She said the militants, when they encountered them, they were saying to the girls, come with us, we're here to help you. And they were dressed in military fatigues, so some of the girls thought that they were soldiers. But Fatima herself said she noticed that they were wearing flip-flops. They weren't wearing proper military boots. Mm. And they also had beards, which she knew wasn't normal for soldiers. So she ran. She knew that they were Boko Haram, and she ran away.
Well, 2 days after the attack, the governor of the state announced that some of the girls had been rescued, but then he backtracked on that and said that a rescue never happened. What are you hearing from the families? They must be devastated through all this.
That was a really peculiar development. And from the parents that we spoke to, they said that was the most crippling part of the whole week for them, that first week that their daughters were missing, because they were told on Wednesday evening that there had been a rescue and they were expecting the girls to be brought back. They'd been told that by the state government. And then instead, what happened on Thursday is that the governor came to their town and addressed them. And he told them that they hadn't been rescued. That was really devastating. Some of the parents we spoke to said that they fainted when they heard the news, and others got very angry and pelted the governor's car with stones. So for a few days after, there was a very tense relationship, a tense atmosphere between the state authorities and the parents themselves.
And we've seen this before. Remind us why kidnapping girls has become the calling card of Boko Haram. Is it a matter of forcing them to be wives, forcing them into some sort of fighting capacity?
Well, there's many reasons. And one of them, I think, at the beginning was that they were using these girls as an incentive for fighters. As you said, they're forcing them to marry young men who'd also been conscripted into the group. And then there was this really disturbing development. They started using girls as suicide bombers, and they realized that they would get more publicity, that people would be more shocked by that. And also, we know that hostages are currency for Boko Haram. There have been several high-profile negotiations where hostages have been released, and we found out later that the government have paid money to the militants. So for those three reasons alone, it makes sense for them to kidnap, and it makes sense for them to kidnap girls. Mm. And of course, the publicity, the huge publicity they got from the Chibok kidnapping in 2014, I guess paved the way for something like this to happen again.
But at that time, the presidents promised that something like this would never happen again. And I understand the pressure is mounting on him to act, to do something, to make it stop.
Well, yeah, the one of the key things is that was a previous administration. That was the presidency of Goodluck Jonathan. And when this president, Muhammadu Buhari, came in, he criticized Goodluck Jonathan a lot for his failure to deal with the Boko Haram crisis. So it's ironic, and it's also a lot of criticism has come on Muhammadu Buhari for allowing the exact same thing to happen again, really. And we know that this school wasn't being protected. We found out in the last 2 weeks of the course of, as more and more details are coming out on this story, that the army had pulled out of Dapchi town in the weeks before this attack happened. And they put out a press release saying that they didn't have the capacity to protect every town and village in northeast Nigeria, and that they expected it was the job of the police to protect the town. But either way, whether it's army or police, the failure, of course, is on the federal government, because they're not protecting children, they're not protecting schools, especially big girls' schools in areas where Boko Haram are known to operate.
Any clue where these girls might be?
Nothing so far. The only thing the government have said is that they expanded the search a few days ago beyond Nigeria's borders. And it would make sense that the girls had been taken to either Niger, Chad, or Cameroon. If the girls were taken, it would make sense that it's taking so long to find them now.
The BBC's Stephanie Haggerty in Nigeria. Stephanie, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.